Section86.com. We're changing the world of podcasting, one show at a time.
Hello, my name is George Takei. Before we get started, we would like to remind everyone that this show is for entertainment purposes only. Three quarters of this crap is total BS anyway. The views and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the hosts and should not be associated in any way with our guests and sponsors. If you are easily offended, we recommend you press stop right now. But if you do, you will deprive yourself of the most amazing auditory orgasm. And who doesn't enjoy a good auditory orgasm? Oh my. Welcome to It Burns When I Pee.
Welcome to the dirty stalls of It Burns When I Pee. For the past 6 years, the podcasting god,
hallelujah,
Blake Clayton, has brought you the best music, interviews, and comedy on the interweb. So sit your asses down, grab a hold of those handicap rails, grab a cocktail, and enjoy our next generation of auditory dysentery. Join Blake and his revolving door of cast members as they bring you another fucked up episode of It Burns When I Pee.
1, 2, 3, 4. When I turn my radio down, I hear it's pop country. Oh, corporate jerk, sure, get on my nerves. That ain't country to me.
Now it burns when I pee. It burns when I pee.
That's what Nashville did to me. So let's take a piss on the Nashville music bit. Cause
now it burns when I pee.
Follow that, bitch.
I'm a rolling stone, all alone and lost. For a life of sin, I have paid the cost. When I pass by, all the people say, just another guy on the lost highway. Just a deck of cards and a jug of wine, and a woman's lies makes a life like mine. Oh, the day we met, I went astray. I started rolling down that lost highway. Not bad, just a kid like you. And now I'm lost, too late to pray. Lord, I paid the cost on the lost highway. Now, boys, don't start your rambling around on this road of sin. Your sorrow bound. Take my advice, or you curse the day you started rolling down that lost highway.
Me, and there's no use to try.
Hearts get broken either way, so just turn around and walk away. It's over, so say goodbye. So say goodbye to dreams that won't come true. Say goodbye to love we never knew. It's over and it's ended. It's finished and we're done. The whole thing was a lie. So say goodbye. And we're done. The whole thing was a lie. So say goodbye.
All right, welcome, folks, to another episode of It Burns in IP. And we have a special guest, good friend, first time ever guest on IBWIP, the one and only Joey Alcorn. Joey, how you doing, buddy?
Oh, that was a long time ago. It was about 6 or 7 years ago now.
Yeah, it was about 6 years ago. I think we had met at the Hank Williams Museum, got in touch with each other, and from there we've talked a lot over the years.
Oh yeah, yeah, we've known each other, been to shows together, and steel guitar shows, and all kinds of things.
So let's get up to date with what's going on with you. You know, it's been a while since we talked. Your last album, All Alone Again, was, I think, 2009?
Right.
So what have you been doing since then?
Well, in 2010, I started on the new record, Nothing Left to Prove, and we're done with that. We finished it in 2011. I think we were done. We were looking at the dates the other day in the studio, and I don't know, just kind of, for a year, I just didn't do anything. I just kind of hung out and stayed at home and cut the grass and things like that. And, and I was sitting on that album because I want to try to do a more proper release for it than we have in the past. With 50 Years Too Late, I had some help with the PR and stuff on that album, and it helped tremendously with, like, the reviews and things like that. But when I did All Alone Again, I didn't have any money for that part of the release process. So really, I've been sitting on it, just getting the money together to give it a more proper release because, you know, you can throw an album out there and put it on iTunes and your website and all that stuff, and it's just kind of like, you know, throwing a baby into the world and saying, hey, good luck, sure. You know, and there's not really any kind of help or push for it. So with Nothing Left to Prove, we just want to put a little bit more of a PR push behind it, I guess you could say.
And that's one of the things that, you know, we've talked about the music business many, many, many times. And that's one of the things I've always commended you about. You know, there is that sense of independence and wanting to do everything independently, but there's also the realization that, you know, to put the best product out there, there's got to be money in the pipeline for, you know, for many different things.
And that's one of my favorite misconceptions people have about the industry is, you know, when people say, oh, well, this guy was a, you know, in any field of music, you know, they call someone a one-hit wonder. And really, a one-hit wonder comes about when someone puts all their eggs in one basket for one song, pushes that song, has the hit, has no money to follow up with another single.
Right.
So in the mainstream, of course, you know, in the independent world, that's not that big of a deal. But in the mainstream, you know, if you're trying to go to pop country radio or pop radio, or, you know, I don't think there is rock radio anymore, But, you know, if you're trying to go down one of those avenues, you have to have more than one bullet in the gun, so to speak.
And ultimately, I mean, if you think everything out and you do things the right way, I mean, ultimately it's going to be a lot more lucrative for you in the long run.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it just pays off more. The album has a longer lifespan. The more press and promotion you get at the beginning, you know, the better the album, the better life the album will have.
Sure.
So, you know, and I'm the type of person, I would rather wait for one good record than to try to rush out, you know, three or four and cram them together and, you know, just space it out some.
Sure. And with the new album, I've heard it, and there is a different feel. It's not the quote-unquote normal Joey Alcorn feel. What were you kind of pushing for and sound-wise for this album?
Well, you know, it's kind of weird. You know, you evolve as an artist and a writer and, you know, all that sort of stuff people say. I look at the three records, including this one that'll be coming out, they're kind of like a trilogy. And to me, they kind of embody 40s, 50s, and 60s country. And as the albums progress, they kind of go through this evolution. And the people that you know, like you, that have the new album say, you know, it feels different, but it just feels like a natural evolution of
sure.
what you've always done.
Sure.
So that's kind of what I was going for. And, you know, with this one here, I mean, it's predominantly like pedal steel. You know, some of the guitar work is a little bit different than the stuff from the first two. But, you know, it's still classic country, and it's still, you know, stuck in that 50s type groove. But I just went for a more 60s sound, I guess, more of like a, I don't know, maybe say a little more of a Haggard influence or something.
Now, does that, you know, having that and wanting that sound, does that come more... is it just as much the lyrics as it is the music when you put the music to it, or is it a kind of a combination of both, or is it more focused, you know, you get that sound from the music?
I mean, it's kind of both to me. Some of the songs on this album would have been really out of place on like 50 Years Too Late. You know, they're not that straight up 40s non-pedal steel type country. And, you know, and by the same virtue, some of the songs that I did on that record, you know, wouldn't be the same on this record. So, but I always have a thing, two things I like to say when I make a record, the way I look at it, is number one, you never want to make the same record twice. You always want to be involving, you know, evolving and doing something new, adding something new, but still stay true to your roots of what you came from, what you want to do. But there's nothing wrong with experimenting and trying new things. And secondly, if you ever make an album that everybody likes every track, you've made an album that someone will hate the whole thing.
Right, right.
So I love it. With my other two records, people will say, you know, like with 50 Years Too Late was, you know, the most polarizing. You know, people say, man, I loved your record, but God, I hated that Graveyard Bound. That song's terrible. And then on the flip side, I've had people say, man, that's the best song on the record.
Right.
So therefore, you know, you kind of appeal to different types of people. And, you know, and honestly, there's very few records out there that I could really say I like every song.
Sure. You're also featured in the book that just came out, Outlaws Still at Large, by Neil Alexander Hamilton. How did you get involved with that project?
Neil had sent me an email probably, well, 2 years ago now, as a matter of fact, and, you know, said that he was going to be putting together this book, and it was going to focus on, you know, people like in our world, you know, the underground country, and he told me some of the people that he wanted to talk to, and, you know, and some of them I knew, some of them I didn't, and me and Neil just, you know, got to talking, and, you know, I started kind of helping him out and putting him in touch with different people, you know, that I felt like should have been in the book. And, you know, 2 years later, he finished the project and released it. And, you know, he's trying to do a push with that and try to get the word out about that project. And it was something really fun to be involved in. And, you know, I think for everybody in the book, you know, it was quite an honor for someone to take an interest in what we're trying to do with country music and to write about it.
Sure. And, you know, I'm about a third of the way through the book, and I'm really enjoying it so far. But, you know, one of the things that always comes up, you know, I'm interviewing a lot of artists over the years, you know, the word outlaw, and I think to me it's pretty much thrown around a lot nowadays, both in pop country and kind of in our roots scene.
Right.
What do you think? Do you think that we just need to get rid of the outlaw label altogether, come up with something new, or do you think it's even necessary to put a label on what we're doing?
You know, years ago, I used to think that was important, and I used to really worry about, like, how I branded myself, you know. And, I mean, if you put classic country, you know, people are going to think you're like a Hank Williams imitator or something. If you put outlaw, they're going to expect, like, a Waylon-type imitator. And you know, and I mean, I guess all those genre names have their connotations that they're going to relate to. But to me, it doesn't matter. People, at this point in time, people understand. And this goes for, like, pop country people and main, whatever, you know, the different sects of country music that exist. People understand that there's different types of country music now. And I think 20 years ago, that was not the case. People didn't really understand that there was the, you know, alternative country, Americana, rockabilly, psychobilly. But now I think the people in general are more aware.
Sure.
So, you know, it's like I've always said with the terms and stuff, if would you put the Misfits and Elvis Presley together on the record rack in rock music? You know, no, you wouldn't, because they're absolutely nothing alike. But if you walk into a record store or Walmart, whatever, whoever still sells records today, you're going to see Hank Williams on the shelf with Jason Aldean.
Right.
And that is just a product of back in the 60s, Billboard magazine didn't want to subcategorize country music because they didn't believe that the competition amongst the different subgenres would be healthy for the genre as a whole. And that's why that never happened in country, but it happened in rock.
Sure.
So, you know, it would be cool. I mean, I think it should be, you know, set up differently. There should be certainly be those compartments, but does it really move forward what people are doing? I don't think so. Not anymore.
Right.
It's really not necessary.
And I think, you know, just like Neil talks about in the book, I mean, it was called outlaw country, you know, in the 70s when Waylon and Willie were doing this stuff, because they were doing stuff completely against, you know, the way it was being done.
Right.
done on Music Row. Music Row has gone back to that. I mean, they never left it, really. You know, just some people did stuff and were successful doing it a different way. But Music Row is doing things exactly the same as they have been for a long time. And, you know, we have a lot of bands that are amazing artists and bands that, you know, don't get mainstream airplay or, you know, get videos made or sell a bunch of records, and they're making great music. But
right.
It's not necessarily anything. I don't want to say it's not new, because a lot of the stuff that's being made is new and different, but you're not having to go against a different animal. You know, it's the same animal. So, you know, to use outlaw again, I don't know. I don't know if I'm articulating it right, but I mean, you can only do something like that one time, you know, and then you got to, if it's a different revolution, you got to call it something else.
Well, yeah. And I think what you're trying to say is the outlaw revolution happened with Willie and Waylon and those guys and even Hank Jr. and stuff. But the outlaw genre is newer than the outlaw movement.
Sure. Sure. It went from,
I mean, at their time, it wasn't a genre. It was just something they started calling it. And then post those events, it became a genre.
Sure. I'm glad I got you around to, you know, to define what I'm trying to say. It's helpful.
Well, yeah, that's what it sounded like you were trying to say.
Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I don't, you know, and I think I said in the book, you know, and so did several other people in the chapters I read, I don't think of myself as an outlaw. If anything, I'm just a honky tonk singer. You know, I'm not a crooner. I don't sound like Farron Young or Dean Martin, you know, and I'm not, you know, Jim Reeves. I just do honky tonk music, and that works for me, just calling it that.
And like I said earlier, when we first met was at the Hank Williams Museum, and that's kind of, we're kind of going now into one of the projects that you have going. But can you remember the first time that you went to the Hank Williams Museum in Montgomery?
Yeah, it was in 1998, and it was a year before the museum officially opened. And I had read online that there was a Hank Williams Museum, you know, in Montgomery, and I was like, wow, it's, you know, an hour away from home. I want to ride over there and check it out. So I got in my car and drove over there, and it was at the Union Station train building that's downtown there at the time was the original location. So I walked in, you know, expecting to see all these Hank Williams displays and things. And I was real excited and got in there, and it was a table with some T-shirts. And they were essentially raising money to help open the museum. It hadn't opened yet. So, you know, my first trip over there was kind of a bust as far as, you know, seeing any Hank Williams memorabilia. But, you know, a year later they opened, and they've been open ever since. And I think it was in 2001 or 2002, they moved to the current location on Commerce Avenue in Montgomery, and they've been there ever since, going strong. And you know, they have tens of thousands of visitors from all over the world.
And you know, it's a special place. I mean, if you're a Hank Williams fan, but you know, even if you're not a Hank Williams fan, it's definitely got a lot of interesting stuff. You can go through it once or twice and still not, you know, see everything. What is your relationship with the museum? What has it meant to you?
Well, you know, being a fan of Hank Williams, I was just fortunate to live an hour away from where he was from. So I got to spend a lot of time over there and with people from his family and, you know, people that played with him. And, you know, and all those people are almost gone now. So it was a very cool thing for me, you know, in the past 16 years of my life or so, to be involved with all that and get to know those people. And it was just kind of surreal, because I remember being 14 years old reading the Colin Escott biography of Hank, and you know, 2 or 3 years later I was meeting all those people that book talks about,
right?
And that was really cool. But as far as musically, you know, I mean, it's kind of one of the places that my career began as a performer, because I used to, hell, some days I'd skip school, and sometimes on the weekend, and I'd take my guitar and just drive over there to Montgomery and sit in that train station and play, you know, and people would be coming through and looking at the displays, and I'd just be sitting there singing, and they'd, you know, give me tips and stuff, and, you know, and it always paid for my trips over there, and, you know, and Beth and Cecil, the people that run the museum, you know, they've always just treated me like family and been just as good to me, so, you know, they're just kind of like family to me, I guess you could say.
Definitely. Well, you came to me a couple weeks ago with a project that you were starting to work on. Why don't you kind of tell folks about the project is, and you know, how it came about?
Well, you know, earlier this year, Braxton Schuffert died, and Braxton was one of Hank's earliest musical idols. Braxton had a radio show on WSFA in Montgomery. And when Hank moved there when he was young, you know, 13, 14 years old, he would listen to Braxton's radio show every morning. And a lot of times he would miss the bus or be late for school or whatever because he was listening to this show. And he met Braxton, and Braxton incorporated Hank into his show. He was impressed with him. And a lot of people, things you read, have the story wrong, and they make it sound like Braxton was in the Drifting Cowboys. But it was really Hank joined Braxton's band. And then the first version of the Drifting Cowboys, which was Hank and Hezzy's Drifting Cowboys, evolved from Braxton's band. So that was kind of a guy that was like a very big part in the beginning of Hank Williams' life. And also this year, we lost Charles Carr, who was the kid that was driving Hank the night that he died on the way to Canton, Ohio. And Charles he's always been just a very, you know, like a stoic, well-spoken dude. He always came to a lot of the Hank events. He was always very nice to me. I've, you know, spent a lot of time talking to him, and, you know, it's unfortunate that we lost him too. But I stopped by the museum after I heard that Charles had died on my way to Nashville a few weeks ago, and they had the lyrics on display by the Cadillac to an old song called The Death of Hank Williams. And the song was written by an Alabama disc jockey named Jack Cardwell. And it was the very first Hank Williams tribute song to ever be written, recorded, and be on the radio. And within a week or two of Hank's death, it was, I'm not sure if it was number one. I hadn't found the chart history on it. but it was a big hit on radio. So anyway, I was driving to Nashville and I got to thinking, I said, man, yeah, I'd heard that song years ago. People had told me about it. Up until the time YouTube came out, though, I had never heard the original recording because it had never been available on any CDs or anything you could buy. So I just had these old people tell me about this song, and it was really cool, and it kind of just tells the story of that last trip. But I was thinking about how this was the only song that mentioned Charles Carr, because it has a line there about the driver reaching into the back to wake the sleeping man and all this stuff, you know, and finding him dead. So I've always wanted to record the song. So anyway, I had the idea for this project to record a CD with that song on it and have it for sale at the Hank Williams Museum and have all the money go directly to the museum as, you know, not necessarily a fundraiser or anything like that, but just another avenue for the museum to get revenue. So I called Beth at the museum, and I told her about the idea, and she said, oh, that's great. She said, people always ask where we can get that song, and it's not available anywhere. And I said, great. I said, let's do it. So we had the idea to do a crowdsourcing campaign for it, and the project just kind of grew from there, and started talking to some more friends of mine about it and telling people about it, and everybody, you know, wanted to get involved, so... Now we're up to like somewhere between, I think, 12 and 15 tracks for the final product.
Awesome.
And just, it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be a very different type of Hank Williams tribute record in that there's no Hank Williams songs on it right now. So, I mean, I'm still kind of planning and developing this thing in my head. But it's really going to be some tribute songs and some songs that relate to Hank's life and death.
Sure.
And for instance, joining me on the CD will be Jake Penrod from Texas. He's going to do Braxton Schuffer's song, Rockin' Chair Daddy. Me and Rachel Brook are going to record Hank's favorite song, according to a 1952 Country Song Roundup interview. It's an old gospel tune called Death Is Only a Dream. And we're going to do that and make it kind of like one of the old Hank and Audrey type recordings. We're going to have a version of Midnight on there, which was the last song that Hank Williams ever sang as he was driving to Canton that night. So it's going to be a pretty big project. Most of it's already come together. Like I said, I kind of know in my head what it's going to be. I haven't come up with a name for it yet, but the cool thing to me, though, is that I'm going to get to do a Hank Williams project that will be a benefit for the museum.
Exactly.
And that's the only place it'll be available, and that's the only place you'll be able to get these songs.
Awesome. So when does the fundraising start to get, you know, and how long is it going to last?
We're going to run it through September 1st. The project is actually live right now. We have it up on Indiegogo. And you can go there and check it out. You'll have a link to it.
Yeah, we'll have a link to it on the show notes, and we'll be posting stuff on IBWIP with the link.
Okay, cool. So, you know, your listeners can go check it out. We put together some really cool reward packages, perk packages. I don't know what you call those things, but we got a bunch of cool stuff from the museum that we're going to be giving away. Everything from posters and prints to stickers and all the way up to lifetime memberships to the museum, where you get to take your picture with the car and have your name on a plaque inside the museum, and a little 7-inch resin statue that's a replica of the Hank Williams statue in downtown Montgomery.
Awesome. And so, all that reward,
really cool things.
Yeah, all that reward information is then, you know, it's on the Indiegogo site.
Right, yeah.
Awesome.
So, and you know, we got some cool people. Kenneth Marr, who I recently met, he did the artwork for the Outlaw Still at Large book, and he's going to do a limited edition, I guess you'd call it, portrait of Hank that's going to be exclusive for this project. And when me and him started talking about when he wanted to be a part of it, I said, well, you know, he said, well, I'd like to do a print of Hank for this thing. I said, well, cool. I said, let's do it. But I said, let's do a picture that people don't see all the time. Because, you know, you see the same poses of Hank,
sure,
you know, a million times over. So I went through my collection of unpublished photos of Hank and picked out a really cool one that Kenneth is going to do.
Awesome. And how long, I mean, when are you, do you have like a timeline of when you got, you're going to try to have the whole thing wrapped up and the CD available?
We're wanting to launch it at the birthday, which is going to be September 14th at the museum. And all of the artists, with the exception of Rachel, I think are going to be able to be at the museum for the launch of it. So, you know, hopefully that'll be a really cool thing and I can get it all done by that time.
Awesome. You got a lot of work ahead of you in the next month and a half.
Yeah, well, it beats cutting the grass, man. I'm tired of cutting the grass every week, so it gives me something different to do.
And here's a question I have. It is, you know, if Hank Williams Sr. was around today, you know, what do you think his opinion of pop country would be right now?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I hate to say anything that I think Hank would think because, you know, I don't know. But I know from, like, talking to Don Helms and stuff, you know, at the time, he wasn't a fan of pop music of his time. He didn't like horn sections and trumpets and things. He wasn't really a big Bob Wills fan. He was just really into just simple music and, you know, three-chord songs, I guess you could say. Because I know one time I actually asked Don and Braxton Schuffert, because they spent so much time working with Hank, you know, did he ever sing like any Jimmy Rogers songs? And they were like, no. You know, they didn't ever remember him doing any of that. And I've always thought that was kind of strange, being as, you know, such an influential figure Jimmy was,
sure,
in the, you know, 20s and 30s of country music. And Hank would have been a kid at that time. But I don't know. I mean, just knowing people his age, I mean, they don't seem to like it.
Yeah.
So I don't think he would, you know, I don't think he would listen to it. But at the same time, I don't think Hank would make it a point to go out and disparage,
sure, sure,
you know, what other people were doing either.
Sure.
And just like when Tony Bennett recorded Cold, Cold Heart, you know, Hank would play it everywhere they went. You know, like when they would stop at these restaurants and stuff and there was a jukebox, Don Helms said that, you know, Hank would always put a nickel in and play Tony Bennett's Cold, Cold Heart. So maybe he liked it if they were singing his song. I don't know.
Well, that's always helpful. Well, man, it's as always, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I love, you know, we sporadically talk to each other, but you know, through the years, but when we do, it's pretty focused and it's pretty, you know, intensive, you know, discussions, and I honor your friendship and I honor your music and I really honor what you're doing here. I mean, the museum has to, you know, it's pretty self-sufficient, you know, and it doesn't get, you know, government assistance or anything. And,
no.
And so this is projects like, no, these are really important.
It's strictly funded by people coming in there. So what, you know, what we're trying to do is just, if there's a CD, it's $10 to go through the museum. So if there's a CD in there for $10 and, you know, we can sell it to everybody or even half the people that come through, that's a, you know, 50 to 100% increase in their revenue.
Exactly.
Per person. So, you know, and I know a lot of people, you know, I know you've been there, you know, you're from Illinois, and they have people from all over the world and all over the country that do come down. But, you know, it's just, it's a really cool thing if you're a Hank Williams fan, like you said earlier, to go in there and see his clothes and to see his Cadillac and to see his boots and, you know, all these different,
sure,
things. And, you know, part of my mission when I started doing music, when I was, you know, 15, 16, wherever I decided I wanted to do this, was that, you know, I always wanted to honor what Hank Williams had done and what his music meant to me. And I know that his music, you know, means a lot to a lot of people around the world. So I've just been fortunate enough to be in a position that, you know, I can help do these things.
Sure.
So it's something that I'm proud of, and I'm always proud of anything, you know, I do that's associated with Hank Williams.
Exactly. Well, buddy, you know, keep in touch with us. Let us know if we can help you in any way. And when the new album, Nothing Left to Prove, comes out, you definitely let us know, and we'll have you back on.
We'll do it.
All right, buddy. Take care of yourself.
All right, man. We'll see you.
I try so hard, my dear, to show that you were my every dream. Yet you're afraid each thing I do is just some evil scheme. A memory from your lonesome past keeps us so far apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart? Another love before my time made your heart sad and blue. And so my heart is paying now for things I didn't do. In anger, unkind words are said that make the teardrops start. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart? You'll never know how much it hurts to see you sit and cry. You know you need and want my love, yet you're afraid to try. Why do you run and hide from life? To try it just ain't smart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart? There was a time when I believed that you belonged to me, but now I know your heart is shackled to a memory. The more I learn to care for you, the more we drift apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart?
Hello, I'm Christopher Walken. IBWIP is an interactive show. That means get off your asses and get a hold of us, baby. You can call into the show live or leave us a voicemail. The number is 1-203-429-4711. It's free, so dial it up now, I implore you. You can also email us with questions or comments at blake@ibwip.com. You can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and subscribe to your Pia Vision YouTube page. All the links are on the front page of ibwip.com.
Chicago.
Chicago, a broken heart is still the same.
Are you a blogger or a podcaster, or you're just not happy with your web hosts? You need to check out HostGator.com. You're going to find web hosting made easy and affordable. HostGator offers unlimited disk space, unlimited bandwidth, one-click script installs with a free site builder, and the best control panel out there. Stop by today and try a free demo to see how easy it is. And if you use the special coupon code Section8686, you'll save 25% off your web hosting packages. What do you got to lose? Check out HostGator.com and take a bite out of your web hosting costs.